Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 12th, 1996. In the Creekside room this morning, our speaker is Marilyn McDonald. Kristen approached to money management, session 3. Let's listen in.
I'm Marilyn McDonald. I'm a certified financial planner in private practice. I've been in private practice since 1983. I live in Gig Harbor, Washington, which is about 200 miles west and slightly south of here. As it mentions in the bio out on the kiosk, the author of this book, which was published by Zondervan Publishing, and I'm using it as a curriculum, as a guide for this class. The first two classes, we talked about how we approach handling our money, whether or not we approach it with any kind of specific attitude. And I thought I would just very briefly review that, because I think it's important. The bottom line for anybody, Christian or non-Christian, in my opinion, when you approach handling money, is that you have an ethical way to handle it. If it's unethical, of course, it creates trouble. The Christian approach is from an ethical perspective, and people, believers, frequently want to use that because they want to please God. Non-believers frequently enjoy using the Christian approach, and I've spoken to many, many non-believing people who like the Christian approach to money, because they recognize that there is a defined ethics bias that they like. So I'm going to review just briefly what that is based on. As I said, see, I'm really warm when I put my glasses back on, they fog up. As I said in the first hour, God does have a perspective on money. If you've read this book from the front to the cover, you'll note that the Bible says a lot about money and material possessions. And when you note that, if you do notice it, you think, why is it such a common subject? Well, the reason is, there are actually a number of reasons, that it's a very practical way to teach a lesson, because everybody, in every age, of every circumstance, handles something resembling money. There are some means of exchange. So it's common to all people, all times. It's also symbolic of many things. But the bottom line is that money is a symbol of our inner condition. Money symbolizes our attitude about many things. And from a Christian perspective, that is that it mirrors the condition of our heart. And more than anything, God's interested in our heart. If you will look, if you have scripture, and if you don't, you can make a note of this, into Matthew. Let's see, what will we use? Matthew. Let's use Luke. Luke was the one that I think said it best. Luke 16. Verses 10 and 11, and then we'll skip up to verses 15. Luke 16:10 says, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much." So if you haven't been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? Then it jumps up on 15. When the Pharisees heard this, they mocked Jesus and sneered at him and said, who do you think you are? All those things that they accused him of being. And he looked at them straight in the eye and he said, "You're the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your heart." Hearts, plural. So when he gave that teaching on being trustworthy with material possessions, etc., he summed it up by emphasizing that God knows your heart. And that's the key to the whole concept of the Christian approach to money, the ethical, biblical approach And of course, that's just one scripture. There are many, many, almost 1,000, in fact, scriptures that deal with that subject. God is interested in how we handle money for our own good, as well as because he's God, because it mirrors the condition of our heart. If we're trustworthy with a little bit of, just only a little bit, then we're not ready to handle a lot. In my experience as a financial planner, I've run into an awful lot of people with an awful lot of money. And I can tell the difference between those whose attitude is right and those whose attitude is not right, pretty much from the first 5 or 10 minutes of our conversation. And I know pretty much from talking to them how successful they'll be with their money in terms of accumulating it and multiplying it, which is the object, and how that's going to affect them personally. And I've seen lots and lots of people with lots and lots of money who are very good at multiplying it, which the Bible says for us to do. We are instructed, commanded to multiply it. And yet, because their heart is not right, it has become a burden to them. It's not a blessing, it's a curse. So the bottom line is, after you get to a place where you can handle some money, you know, there's a little bit passing through your hands, or maybe a lot, it should be a blessing and not a curse. And that doesn't always happen. So any amount can be good or bad. You can have a little and suffer, or you can have a lot and suffer.
Would you expand upon that point about being mandated to multiply?
In the parable of the talents, for instance, as an example, where he says, you know, he gives the first servant 10 talents and says, go out and, you know, manage it, and then another servant 5, go out and manage it, and then another servant 1, go out and manage it. The first guy comes back and he's doubled the 10. That's a pretty good return. Of course, we don't know how long the master was gone.
Rolling stock,
right. We're going to get to that principle in a minute, so maybe this is what he did. But then the second guy went out and he took his 5 and he brought back 10, so he doubled it. But the third servant only came back with the original 1 because he was afraid, and he was cursed, and it was taken away from him. So the concept, and there are many more scriptures, and we don't have time in an hour, many more that imply that it's not okay to just, you know, stick it in a cookie jar. And that, of course, that could be a symbolic teaching, talking about our lives, yeah, as well as our money. Yeah, right. But I think if you take that plus all the others in context, he says you could have at least given it to the bankers and got interest. So in context, it appears that money being a tool, if our hearts are right, multiply it.
How did that play in the earlier church when the
I wasn't there. I don't know for sure.
Well, the official church condemned the Jews for money lending, for example, in the Middle Ages.
Well, in Jewish law, usury was only amongst the Jewish people. It didn't apply to Gentiles. So the early church came in and had to interpret that. And I don't know the answer to your question, except that if you in the time of Christ, if you were a Jew and you charged interest to another Jew, that was forbidden. But you could charge interest to other people.
I'm talking about later, as events led up to the Inquisition throughout Europe. One of the hues and cries was the Jews must burn their usurers.
I don't know. Maybe they were.
Oh, they were, for sure.
Yeah. In that case, I would say that the question would be, what was the condition of their hearts being usurers?
The point being that the church was not adhering to this admonition. They were speaking against it.
Oh, I see.
Directly against it.
Well,
most of the time,
let's finance alone.
Two ways to look at it. You know, and not everything an individual or an organization does is always correct, and I think we probably could recognize that. Now, the church may have been right, the church may have been wrong, but we know what Scripture says, and that is our guide. Now, you know, you can multiply money and do so with greed, in which case the multiplying of the money is wrong. But you can multiply money and do so with a good motive and your heart being right, in which case the multiplying is right. Correct? Okay, we're going to talk about investments then with that as a background. Those of you that took the other class know how many categories of investments there are. Those of you who didn't take the class, how many categories of investments are there?
Four.
What are they?
RE.
Real estate.
Debt. Natural resources. Equity.
Excellent. Okay, there are four categories of resources, or of investments only. Everything fits into one of these categories in one way or another. And my job as a financial planner, by the way, I work only with people in crisis. So I really have, it's really important for me to make things understandable, because people in crisis are under a lot of stress. So there's no point in making it more complicated than it has to be. So I've worked hard for many years to make things as clear and straightforward and easy to understand as possible. A lot of investments have a lot of fancy names, and they change every 10 years. But they will still all fall into these categories. Real estate is self-explanatory, and I'm primarily talking about real estate that you own as an individual or a couple or a family. Usually I'm talking about your home or an apartment building that you own, not with 100 or 300 or, you know, 1,000 other people, but you and your small family group own this real estate, a house, an apartment, a duplex, something of that nature. This is primarily residential, but it could be, maybe you own a warehouse or something like that, but you own it, you and your immediate family. Here in this category, equity, I'm talking primarily stock, but it could be and mutual funds that own stock. Equity means ownership. So you own a piece of whatever it is, a corporation, a business, something. You have ownership in it. That's what I mean by equity. And there are a lot of things that could fall into that category. Mostly stock and mutual funds. Natural resources are higher risk, and they are probably not appropriate for everybody. My opinion is they're certainly not appropriate for everybody. Natural resources are investments in agriculture, timber, mining, fish farming, fishing in general, orcharding. What are some other natural resources?
It could be oil, too.
Oil, yeah.
And gas.
Energy.
Mines.
Mines, silver, gold, jewels, gems in general. All that kind of stuff. Renewable resources are the natural resource investments. And there's a lot of risk with those. Sometimes the drilling of oil, you get nothing. The investor could lose everything plus more money, especially if an investor borrows money to make the investment. And yet on the other hand, once in a while, these things really pay off big. So for most people, you don't ever get to that point, but if you do, it's probably only going to be about 5% of the total of all the money you invest, with great risk. The majority of people do invest here, and it's not appropriate for most people to put all their money here. They should diversify, in most cases, in these three categories, probably more in equity, because those are the investments that grow more in value. Debt investments are, those of you that took the class the other day, help me out with this. What are some debt investments? Now, when you invest in debt, you do not go into debt. You buy somebody else's debt, and you get paid the interest. You are the lender. Bonds.
Mortgages.
Mortgages, like you hold a real estate contract, or you buy a mortgage-backed piece of paper. What was
corporate and government bonds.
Corporate and government bonds. Anything else?
CDs.
Personal loans
to people. You can actually now buy investment paper that's backed by consumer loans. Higher interest. Yeah, really fancy stuff out there. Another one would be your checking and savings account at the bank.
Life insurance.
life insurance if it has cash value, tax-deferred annuities, tax-sheltered annuities if you're a school teacher and have that.
Real estate contracts.
Real estate contracts. Those are all debts that somebody else has incurred. For instance, if you put your money in the bank has incurred a debt. They basically borrowed your money for a period of time, and they'll pay you interest. These, well, sometimes they'll pay you interest. Money market funds also is a debt investment. You're investing in the money market of an investment group, usually a mutual fund or a pension maybe. Pensions also represent a debt investment. All these, the bank, the credit union, the insurance company, the government, the corporation, they issue you this piece of paper, usually, that says you have an account, and they pay you interest, and you are to get your principal back at some point. The sooner you are allowed to get your principal back, the lower interest they're going to pay you, because they're going to have to cough up that money quickly. But if you leave it with them for a long time, then they can plan on having the use of it, and they'll pay you a higher rate of return. Most Americans have the vast majority of their investments in this kind of investment. And historically, the rate of return has only been 3 or 4%, and I'm going back about 65 years. And that is not adequate. The rate of return in natural resources is all over the board. Here, the rate of return has historically been about 8%, and that's a little higher than it was 10 years ago because of the tremendous volatility in the real estate market in the last 10 years, with some major collapses of real estate in various parts of the country, and then recoveries. That's kind of skewed that number. But here you're only going to get maybe 4% over a long period of time on average. Here, if you hold real estate, on average, you'll probably only get about 8%. And here in the equity market, you should get 10 to 12%. And that's using stocks. And if you get a good mutual fund, you might get 12 to 14% on average. There are lots and lots of mutual funds that have equity mutual funds. And in some cases, even some mixed mutual funds that are equities like stocks and bonds that have averaged 12 to 14%. There are lots, not just a few. Do you know how many mutual funds there are available today?
7,000.
7,000, plus maybe a couple in the last week or two. So yeah. Maybe 100 more, I'm not sure. Right, about 7,000 mutual funds. So how does an investor choose one? What did we say last week? No, a couple days ago. It wasn't last week. What did we say? What's one way to choose a mutual fund? I personally think you should have, if you're not personally involved enough that you can do it by yourself, you need to get an advisor. I really think you need to get, you need to develop a relationship with an advisor that will work with you on a fee-only basis. And not a commission basis, so they don't have to sell you anything. They simply get to know you, make appropriate judgments as to how much risk you can take and are comfortable with taking and what your goals are, and then recommend to you a group of mutual funds, not one company, but you know, a basket full of mutual funds, and then educate you as to what they are, why they're appropriate, and educate you until you really understand. I personally believe that before you choose a stock or a mutual fund, you need to know what you're doing. Yeah. And your advisor's job is to teach you. Not sell you, teach you. Wait a second until the fog goes away. Remember the diversification sample example I gave you? I'm going to put it on the board one more time because it's fun. The reason most of us in the business of investing, like in advising,
it's not plugged in.
Okay. Like mutual funds is what? There were two reasons I gave you last.
Put it into the wall.
No,
to the wall behind you.
Two reasons that I gave you that we as advisors like mutual funds. And there's really a couple more. But what are the two reasons that mutual funds are good. They reduce the...
Well, you're diversified.
You diversify in a mutual fund, which will do what? It does two things. If you diversify, it reduces your risk, and it increases your gains. And it really does. Now, that's based on what we call appropriate diversification. For most people, maximum number of mutual funds that you would own is maybe 10 or 12 or 13. If you owned 30 or 50 or something, you kind of kill this theory. It doesn't work anymore. But it's important that you reduce the risk. And it's important, I mean, if the purpose of investing is to increase the multiply it, then using the common sense proven techniques is just wise. The whole book of Proverbs says, get wisdom. Blah, 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 get wisdom. Blah, 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 get wisdom. And so here is something that works. I didn't invent it. You don't have to go out and reinvent the wheel. It already works. An example is this case here of the two couple. The first couple is John and Mary. They have $100,000 to invest. They are extremely conservative and think they can't take any risk. So they put it in a CD or something in the bank, and they get a guarantee of 8% a year, every year. That's not bad, frankly. An 8% guarantee for 20 years is not bad. A lot of people would take it. What do they have? After 20 years, they have $466,096. Mike and Debbie decide to take some risk and diversify. And they put their $100,000 in for 20 years in five different investments. In the first $20,000, they lose all their money. The second $20,000, they don't make any money, but they get their principal back. The third $20,000, they make a big whopping 5%. They would have done better in the bank, probably. Certainly better than the 8%, or certainly better with the 8% that was offered. So they're not doing too well, are they? And they got $60,000 down. Now they do pretty good, but this is only the average. In fact, right now it's a little bit below average in the mutual fund marketplace. They do 10%. But one of the 20,000s does quite a bit better. A little bit better than the average mutual fund. It does 15%. It averages that. What do they end up with? $534,947. The difference is $68,851 more. I think that's interesting. It's really key to understanding what diversification can do for you. Another interesting concept is something I'm going to show you here in just a second. And I've taken these photocopies right out of the book. I can't make you photocopies of this stuff. The publisher won't allow it. I don't own the rights to this book. The publisher does. So you have to read the book, I guess, or memorize the pictures I show you. The other key to investing, there are several keys to investing, but in terms of choosing an investment, you have to determine how much time you have. I personally believe that you need 3 years or more to even consider any kind of bona fide investment. And I'd feel a little bit better if it was 5 years or more. If your goal of accumulating some money or saving money involves needing to use the money, all or part of it, in less than 3 years, you cannot invest. You must just simply save it and not worry so much about the return. But if you've got 3 to 5 years or longer, then sure, you can invest your money and you should invest your money. So knowing that you have that much time should be the, in addition to getting the right attitude and understanding these principles, I'm assuming you've already been educated as to principles, then this was where you would begin, saying, okay, how much time, what is my goal and how much time do I have? Well, if I have 3 or more years, okay, I can start looking at stocks and bonds and bona fide investments. But if I don't, then I'm wasting my money because, of course, pardon?
That depends on when you die.
Yeah, well, if you know when you die, tell me how you figured it out. Another thing that's very key, one of the ladies said in the last meeting, is to take into consideration what economic factor that's always out there that we always have to deal with.
Inflation.
Right. Now, if inflation averages, well, over the last 60-some years, some people say it's been 3%. Others say 4%. I'll use both. I'll say 3 or 4. I don't know. I haven't seen the latest numbers, but that's probably close. If inflation averages 3 to 4%, then you obviously have to get at least that much, right? But there's one other factor on an investment. Most investments are, you have to send money to who?
Taxes.
Most investments are taxable. Okay. So you have to take into consideration taxes as well. In general, you want to get another 3% over the rate of inflation. So at a minimum, your investments have to yield 6 to 8. Well, if your investments yield at 6 to 8, you're treading water. You're only keeping up with the value of money. And you have to keep up with the value of money. So what I tell clients is, you decide what your goal is and you decide what amount of risk you want to take. But I'm going to advise you that we need to get 3 or 4% more than these two things combined. And I sit down and work with somebody until we are both comfortable that this is how they view this, this is what the numbers look like to them, and this is what they're comfortable with. Question? No?
Well, I want to know about rolling stocks, investment in stock.
Okay, we're going to get to that. We have time. So first you get educated, determine where you're coming from internally and become educated, and then you set your goals and your time parameters, take these things into consideration, and then you conclude that you need to get X percent. That's the goal. Now you may not do it, but if you don't have something written down, you won't meet any goal. I mean, you have to have something to strive for. And in most cases, with a little time, a good advisor, common sense, and some diligence on your part, you will reach that goal. It's not that hard to do. Especially knowing that there are lots and lots of stocks and mutual funds out there that do reach that goal on a regular basis. The chart here is simply the effects of inflation chart. And I'm just putting it up for just a second so you can, oh, I don't have it up there very good, do I? So you can get a look at what 5, 7, and, oh, it's not very clear, 10% inflation does to you. There, that's better. Thank you.
That's better.
Over the years. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years at 5%, you know, just decimates the value of your money. And I think people in this room already know that. I'm gleaning that much. But it's nice to review every once in a while. It's helpful to review this kind of thing. So if you aren't keeping up with inflation, then you're making an investment mistake.
I thought inflation rates were going down.
Well, they're down a little bit right now, you know, back in the...
Have we ever reached a 10% inflation?
Oh, yeah, we did for a short period of time during the oil crisis.
That was later than that, 88.
Well, yeah, it followed the oil crisis, but it was as a result of it. Yeah, we did. And, you know, it's interesting because it seems to also... be different in geographical... areas for a period of time. So you might have, for instance, if you lived in Alaska, you know that things cost much more and go up much higher, and there are much more costs attached to it. People in Alaska talk about double-digit inflation a lot more than we do down here, because they experienced it. So it's a little different geographically also.
Here's another factor, too. That market basket is the most basic survival-level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's got things in it that very few, but many retirees have long since set aside.
True. And it doesn't include some of the big-ticket consumer items, like cars and houses.
The more affluent you are, the more big-ticket stuff you're buying.
Right.
I find it runs more like 15 to 20% at this stage of my life from all the things I want to buy.
That's a really good point, that your personal rate of inflation based on what you buy, the consumer items and the services and goods that you buy, could be way different. I look at the government statistics and I think, I don't believe that. But I can't prove it, you know? I'm not out there doing the hands-on research to a bazillion people, and so I can't prove it. But I intuitively know that our costs, for instance, if you have a child in college, I have a daughter in college right now, it's not going up 3 or 4% a year, it's about 12 or 13% a year. If you go out and price cars, well, they're not jumping 3 or 4% a year. It's been much more than that. It's kind of like they went boom, then they went boom, 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 and then boom. Houses, too. So, like he says, the market basket doesn't always include all the items that would affect us as individuals. One of the keys, in my opinion, to diversification, and you can do this with... and if you were in the previous class, and I'm sorry I don't have time to go into all of what we did before, but one of the keys is recognizing that if you want to truly invest over the long term, and if you want to do well, then you're going to need to be in equities. And by equities, I'm referring primarily to stocks. And you know, invariably I get asked, if I'm speaking to a group of 10 or a group of 1,500, I think is about the biggest group I've ever spoken to, invariably I say, all right, people say to me, but stocks are... what?
Risky.
Risky, right?
No.
No, they're not really. Not in the long term. A lot of studies have shown that even if you don't pick your stocks well, if you diversify and you hold them for 20 years, your chances of loss, mathematically, theoretically, are zero. Now, that's hard for some people to believe, but it's true. Your chances of loss decline to zero after 20 years with adequate diversification. Maybe in stocks, maybe 30 or 40, 50 stocks. In mutual funds, maybe about 10. Each mutual fund may have 50, 60 companies in it. So each one of those gives you a great deal more diversification than with one stock. But the theory is the same. You need to be in stocks. And the way to do it, and for most people, is just to go ahead and start with mutual funds or join an investment club. I personally recommend anybody getting started investing in stocks at any age not to do it on the say-so of somebody who says, I got this great stock, I think you should buy this. And I mean a broker or an advisor.
Absolutely.
Or a financial planner like myself, or any professional, or any friend, or your barber, or your uncle, or your brother-in-law. Do not buy stock unless you know exactly why that stock is right for you. And in my opinion, the very best way to do that is in an investment club. Because the purpose of an investment club is to teach you how to select stock. Now, I've been a stock broker since 1981. I do not trade stocks for clients. I just have a broker's license because it helps me. Initially I did, years ago I did, but it helps me to sort of be in on what's happening in that market. It requires I get continuing ed credits, so I learn a little bit every year. That's not my primary area of expertise. I just have the little card. And I basically understand the concepts, but I'm not real expert in that area. So I'm in an investment club. And I've been in one for years, and I'm continually learning new things about selecting stock. If it works for me, I know it'll work for you. How many of you read the Beardstown Ladies book? You need to read it. You need to read it. These little old ladies got together and taught themselves. The National Association of Investment Clubs has a book and have curriculum, and they have meetings, and they teach you how to do this, and you go until you learn. And the first year, you usually lose money. And you think, oh my gosh, what am I doing? But you stick with it. It requires discipline. You stick with it, and gradually, your little club starts to make money. My club in the first year lost 30%, and it was all professional investment advisors. Well, you know, group decision making caused that. I said, "This not you didn't buy the one." I said, "You didn't buy the one I said to buy," because I got lucky and one of them did really well. But these little gals have beat all of the professional averages. They beat the mutual funds. They beat the pension plans. They have done so well that they published this book. And they're not the only example. In general, investment clubs have done far better than any, as a group, any professional group, and than the mutual funds and the pension fund managers, who have to be conservative to a degree because they're regulated. Your little investment club just has to be wise. So I really recommend it. One of the important keys, whether it's an investment club, buying stock, or a mutual fund, is a concept that I think, we're getting close to your subject, and if we don't actually get to it, I'll stay and we'll talk a little bit afterwards, is a key concept called, anybody know what that is? I know you know, don't you give it away. What does that stand for? Anybody know? An investment key. It's called dollar cost averaging. Does anybody know what that means?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Buy a little up on the side, buy a little on the downside.
Right.
So you keep buying and you keep buying.
Yeah, it's a discipline. It's a discipline for investing that works. It's buying a certain dollar amount on a systematic, regular basis, preferably monthly. So in this example, $100 every month equals an average price, because each month your $100 will buy whatever number of shares $100 will buy. Let's say the share prices are all $10 that month when you buy, so you'll get 10 shares. But let's say in another month that the share prices are $5. Well, you'll get 20 shares. Doing it on that basis is called dollar cost averaging. And the reason it's advantageous is over time it tends to, and I'm not a mathematician. I don't totally understand why I could do the math or do a spreadsheet and figure it out. But what it tends to do, in simple language, is bring the cost per share down. And that's what you want. You want to somehow or other get a system for paying less. For instance, here in Washington State, a lot of us ladies like to shop at the Nordstrom's annual sale. And the reason is that Nordstrom, being the Cadillac of many, or the Rolls-Royce or the Mercedes-Benz, of clothiers in Washington State, and certainly one of the finer department stores, has a big annual sale. And they put all of their beautiful merchandise on sale and they mark it down. So I can go and I can spend $400 on a coat sometime during, you know, the off-sale season, or I could go and buy that same coat for $200 and it'll last me 20 years. Now why should I pay $400 for something that I could, if I'm patient and wait 3 months, I can get it for $200? I don't know. I guess if I was impulsive and couldn't, and I wanted to show off to my friends that I was wearing this expensive coat, I'd spend the $400. But that's not wise when it comes to money. The same thing is true with dollar cost averaging. You want to get what you can get at the lowest price. You want it to be on sale. And you can't always pick the time. Nobody knows when the shares are going to be the lowest price. So you use this system to systematically, methodically, without having to think about it, make it happen.
Yeah, but there's one critical inherent assumption in that.
And unless you go in with your
eyes open, you're going to lose your shirt. And that is that the inherent value of that stock is unchanged, and that downside was what you're saying is simply the normal day-to-day crapshoot of the market, the volatility of equities.
Right.
And unless you understand enough about how to compute value, and you don't worry about little details like shrinking market niche, like technologies that are being passed by, like new faces in overseas competition, you can blindly lose your shirt that way.
You can. He's right. You can. Yeah, you can. And again, I emphasize that whether you're picking a mutual fund or a stock, that you work with a professional and that you make sure that you know what you're doing, that you're well diversified, because if you're in 10 mutual funds and you're doing this with 10, or if you're in 50 stocks and you're doing this with 50, one of them, two of them, three of them are going to fall through the basement and be total duds. That will happen. So again, you have to know that that will happen and be prepared for that eventuality. And eventually, you know, after you're doing this for a couple of years, you get a little smarter and you don't make these many mistakes, and yet still that will happen. What's your point?
Well, I agree to a degree. If you buy schlump securities, you can lose your shirt.
Yeah.
If you buy AT&T or GTE or one of the big ones, dollar cost averaging will pay off.
Yeah. There's a lot of volatility in the equities market. I won't deny that.
I've got to counter that. If you bought IBM at 161 and you watched it go down to 49 and it took 8 years to get back to 100, you've still lost your shirt.
If you were my client, though, you probably wouldn't be buying IBM.
And what?
What's going to happen in 16? Well, I'm not a stock investor. I'm a mutual investor.
So. Mutual fund investor.
Yeah,
I think stock investors need to understand that risk is greater than with a mutual fund.
Right.
Mutual funds do have professional management, and some of them have good enough track records that risk is not as great. So for the vast majority of us in this room, rather than take that kind of a risk, which is more so more probable with individual stocks, you would all be better off picking good, solid mutual funds that have been in business for many, many years. 20 plus years is a parameter that I like to use for the bulk of your portfolio, and have routinely gone through the ups and downs in the markets, the volatility of the various mutual fund and stock market kinds of collapses. Those things happen. A mutual fund that's been through all of that, that's been through recession and boom or bust cycle in the economy, in the country that you live in, that's been through all kinds of disasters and still is operating with an average track record that's as good or better than the average of 12%, that's a mutual fund that you probably aren't going to take, that is probably not representing a lot of risk.
The thing about that, though, that is also critical to understand, that's the net asset value. If that mutual fund is consistently returning 12%, when the average yield for all investments is 7% or 8%, you're going to pay a premium in NAV to buy in, which is going to have to be offset before you can really benefit that 12%.
He's referring to what's called net asset value, an easier way to understand. Remember that one of my jobs is to make things understandable, okay? And one of the things I want to emphasize in this class is the lay language. So I would say net asset value to my coworkers and to my peers. I would say to you, the price per share. Now that's not 100% accurate, but you need to understand that each unit that you buy of stock, or each share in the mutual fund, which can be many stocks, your little teeny portion of many companies, has a price. Each unit has a price. and it's called a share price, whether it's a stock or a mutual fund. It then gets valued every day. Every day, at the end of the market day, it gets a value attached to it. The market goes up, the value goes up. That's called net asset value. The market goes down, the value goes down. The mutual fund has problems, the value goes down. The stocks inside the mutual fund lose money, the value goes down. The stocks inside the mutual fund grow in value or pay big dividends or achieve a big capital gain or somehow or other make a big profit, the value goes up. So the net asset value will go up and down. To tell you the truth, I don't care as an investor, because from the day I start investing to the day I die, every month the money goes in. So there'll be years when I overpay. I don't care.
That's right.
There'll be years when I underpay. I don't care. Mm-hmm. The truth is, the less emotionally attached you get to this system,
good point,
and the more disciplined, the better you will do. Yes, you will lose money sometimes. C'est la vie. I trust the author of this Bible,
amen,
who I assume is the Lord God himself. And he tells me that if my motive is correct and my heart is right and I do the work I'm supposed to do, and I'm human and I will make mistakes and I can only do so much, that he will do the rest. And if I'm poor because I've made lots of bad investments, there are only two reasons. Either I have been unwise myself or with my advisors in selecting and making decisions, or God is teaching me something. And that is my bottom line. And I think it's a healthy thing for you to somehow or other come to that kind of conclusion for yourself. I wanted to quickly just show you, so that you could see it in writing, the dollar cost averaging math. Let's see, move this over this way. Basically, we're showing you that if you buy a share at all these various different prices, let me think, maybe it's, well, here it is down here. We'll look at the graph. If you buy a share at all these different prices, let's say that you're going to be real smart and you discipline yourself to invest $250 a month. By the way, if you know young people that are just getting started, tell them they can start with $25 a month in a mutual fund. And they can get, in a few cases now, out of the 7,000, there's probably only about 100 that will do this, but 100 good mutual funds that will take $25 a month for no fees of any kind.
No.
But they do require that you stick with it.
Right.
So you probably are going to be stuck at 25 a month. And I say, gee, what a tragedy. You're stuck at investing 25 a month. You know, give up a beer and pizza once a month. My children in my household, in order to live in my household at age 18, were required to put $25 a month into a mutual fund. You should see them now. They got more money than I do. In this example, you started with $250 a month. In the first month, the share price was $25. So you got $10 for the $250 value. Now that value refers to dollars.
Ten shares,
I'm sorry, for that value of $250. Then the next month you did another $250, but the share price was $27, so you only got 9.259 shares, etc., 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 etc. Over a period of time, this, in fact, period of time, you had invested 3,000 greenbacks. 1 year had elapsed. The average price per share, based on all these different share prices, was $18.48 a share. Now, at the end of the year, the share value, the net asset value that the gentleman was looking at before, could be anything above or below that. Could be. But that's not your concern, because you're just going to do this on a disciplined basis for 40 years.
Right.
Truly, till the day you die, you should be doing this. So,
I just show you the math. Let's say that the share price is, the net asset value is $20 a share. Well, then you've made a little profit. Over time, however, shares tend to go up with inflation. And so gradually, it's going to go up to 20, and then gradually it's going to go up to 25, and gradually it's going to go up to 30. And on average, you make a little bit more money this way, plus you're probably getting dividends and capital gains, which, by the way, should be reinvested automatically in more shares. It's another real important key. And when you buy a mutual fund, and some stocks have dividend reinvestment plans, which gets into the subject of rolling, unless you mean something else, unless you're talking about the category of rolling stock.
I haven't got into it yet. I'm just a little bit in real estate. I just started.
Okay.
And I have a friend that's in it, and he buys stock. He'll sell even a day after he has it for a day.
Okay, we'll talk about that theory in just a second.
He makes more there than he does.
Yeah, that's a valid theory. But what I was talking about was dividend reinvestment, and it's only available in mutual funds and in some annuities that buy mutual fund or stocks and bonds and mutual funds, because some insurance annuities do make mutual funds available. Probably is more appropriate for most people just to buy the mutual funds themselves and not go to an insurance company first. But when they, now this is an increase, every time I walk the screen goes like this, this is an increase in the price per share. This does not reflect the dividends and interest and capital gains that the fund might get, which buys more shares. That's called dividend reinvestment plan, and you can automatically have that done for you by checking a box when you open an account with a mutual fund. You can also do it with some stocks. Some companies, the utility companies frequently do this, say if you buy our stock and make money, we'll automatically buy more shares for you, and in little teeny tiny amounts, but over 20 years, boy, it really adds up. So these shares cost $18.48 each on average, and you got 162.32 shares. The actual dollar gain was $246.40. Now you do that year after year, you compound it. And you add more shares based on dividend reinvestment. I think all we have time for are some questions, and I'll start with this gentleman's question over here, and if somebody will turn the light on. I have arthritis in my fingers, and sometimes I can't get these things to work. The concept that he was mentioning is, he referred to it as rolling stock. There are a couple of other terms, but essentially what it is a system of picking stocks, and you usually need help picking the stocks to do this. You need to really know what you're doing, or you get a broker or an advisor that's real ethical and honest and will really do this for you. But the theory is to choose either 5 or 10 stocks. And you can, generally, these are stocks that have a couple of characteristics. One is that the price is low, or the price is right. The price is right. Low compared to their average. Now, these are going to have to be good, solid companies to begin with. That's why you need an advisor. But assuming that you've found somebody to work with who can recommend to you companies, they're not on the verge of going bankrupt. Good, solid American or foreign companies. They're going to look for a low price, and they're probably also going to look for a good record of earnings and dividends. That kind of gives you, this is real skeleton, kind of an idea of the kind of stock quality that would work in this concept. So what you do is you buy 5, and then at a certain date, sometimes one day goes by, sometimes a month, more often it's a 1 year period of time, you sell them all. And you rebuy the next day, and you do it again the next year. And that's called, it's called a number of different things. It works a little bit better if you do it with 10.
Diversification again.
You know, I'm not sure if it's diversification that makes it work. It's a real technical way to make money in the stock market. Very, very key that you get good stuff, that you get a decent price on that good stuff, and that those things are earning money for you.
It's a record. If you look at the back record, and of course, the broker does it.
Right. The broker will help you do that. You can oftentimes find financial planners who work for a fee. In other words, they have nothing to sell, who specialize in this. I never have, because I work primarily with people in crisis.
I mean, I should ask you this. Do you know Wade Cook, and you know his program? Wade Cook?
No, I don't. Sorry. Where is he? What state is
well,
he in?
Well, he's all over the North.
I mean, where does he live?
I don't know where he is.
Okay.
So he sends me tapes, and he sends me...
I know most of the people in the Seattle area, and some in Alaska.
Yeah.
But I don't know that name.
Well, he started on Tacoma, but I don't know where he is now.
Oh, okay. Well, gee, I'm in Tacoma. Any other questions? Have you got a basic idea, a basic overview? The reason it's important, and the reason that God makes so many mentions of it, is that it mirrors the condition of our heart. So spiritually, money has great significance.
That's right. It really has
a lot to do with who we are. And you know the old saying, you can really get personal with somebody if you start getting close to their pocketbook. Well, even if we don't let anybody else know, God himself does know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy that built the bigger storage bin because he wanted more grain, you know, I'm sure God knew that that was greed.
Right.
You know, and so we always have to kind of stop and check our motives. But the basic thing, once you've got that part straightened out, and you'll never get it 100% straightened out, you always kind of have to repent all the time. Repent of, you know, wanting more. And being at Holden is a good place to realize that you need to repent, you know. It really is. It's wonderful. I think it's kind of like a cleansing time in terms of, you know, material stuff. Nothing wrong with having material things. Nothing wrong with having lots and lots of money. Unless it does something bad to yourself, to your heart. And as you know, by observing many people, if money becomes your God, then that's the worst thing that can happen. And it does, frequently. But also, at the far end of the scale, poverty can become a God. And I have a couple of friends, and they're wonderful, sweet, delightful people, but their goal is to be poor because they will congratulate themselves and, you know, and seriously feel good about being better than other people because they don't have as many material possessions. And there's something wrong with that, too. You know, there's something really wrong with that, too.
Do you recommend annuities?
Do I recommend annuities? Yeah, I think they have a place in almost every portfolio because some of your money has to be secure. You can't have all of it, even at slight risk. A little bit should be secure. A lot should be at modest risk. And the reason you want some of it at no risk is that gives you, and then you might need a different percentage than
because
you
of my
or
age.
Because of
my
your
age is different, but
or your personality. You have to be able to sleep at night.
Yeah.
And if you say, I don't want 10% because I can't sleep, I want 8% because that makes me able to sleep at night, my health and my mental stability is worth more than the higher return, then 8% is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we need to respect each other. I as a professional can't say to you, but you have to get 14% because the marketplace proves it.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my place to say to you that you have to. I would prefer that you do. But if it keeps you awake at night, taking that little bit of risk, then maybe that's not appropriate and suitable. My profession has made some mistakes in that they have pushed that we are all the same and that we all deal with things the same, and we don't. We don't. So yeah, annuities are suitable for most people's portfolio, a different amount, different people. The key is that it be a really good insurance company and that they be competitive. And by that I mean that if the average, and you can ask a planner or an advisor this, what's the average rate of return amongst all annuity companies? And if your company is consistently lower than the average, you got the wrong company. And you need to go find an annuity company that's competitive and consistently pays you a rate of return, which will be guaranteed with no risk to principal,
as much as can happen in this world, on an ongoing basis. And of course, I say that, and this gentleman knows that there is no such thing as no risk. It doesn't.
What was the average? You said they should be in an average.
An annuity, I think, over a long period of time should average 7 or 8%.
No, but I mean, in a group, certain group of insurance companies, they should be in an average of.
Your company should be paying an annual average rate of return as good as the whole insurance industry. All the annuities in the whole industry. So you simply ask your advisor, what is the average of the whole annuity industry? My company should pay that much. I've seen annuities that are 3-4% on average.
Yeah.
Well, that's bad. It should be 7 or 8. Was you, did you have? Did you have a question back here? I think you had your hand up first.
Yeah. Well, I had some comments.
Comments. Okay.
One thing about annuities, insurance annuities, is that you can get shifted around very arbitrarily.
By the company.
Yeah, they can tell you to somebody else and move you around.
Yeah.
Which can be very disconcerting.
Yes, it can be.
If you're somebody else.
Well, you're talking about the employees, the agents that handle it.
No, I'm talking about your annuities. Suddenly you're dealing with.
What's an example of that?
Oh, I know an example. If you were years ago with Executive Life and they got into financial trouble, then bingo, another insurance company came in, took over as receivership.
Buyouts.
Well, that was a rescue. That was the bankruptcy of a company where it got rescued by another company. That does happen. And sometimes a company will voluntarily merge with another, and bingo, you get a letter saying, now you're dealing not with ABC, but XYZ.
Yeah.
That's probably not the biggest risk. I think the bigger risk is that within the company, you deal with a different agent, and then 5 years later, they're gone to some other kind of business, and you get a new agent, and that can be disconcerting, too. Was there another question?
I'm just going to comment that currently the top levels, Travelers and Aetna, are paying 7.5.
Yeah. Jackson National's paying 7 and 8, depending on the length of time.
10-year. 10-year. That's what I'm referring to.
These, I think, were Jackson's were a little bit less than that. But yeah, we're right in the ballpark. 7-ish, 8-ish, maybe, if it's a little longer term. So, and you know, your job is to just try to learn as much as possible and require that whoever is advising you make you understand. His or her job is to teach you and to help you make the right decisions. And in the process of asking questions, of course, there aren't any dumb questions. I hear people say, well, gee, you know, I hate to ask this really dumb question. I say, you're paying me to teach you. Ask the questions. If I don't know the answer, well, you know, I'll go find it out for you. But you have to get the answer. You got to know what it is we're talking about. Not accept, please, never accept your advisor's word as a, you know, some sort of a gospel. It's not. I'll end with one quote, and it was something that I've mentioned a couple times, and that is a quote by John Templeton. As I mentioned earlier, he speaks every year in New York, and he's the guru. He's, I don't know, 80-ish. By now, I've lost track how old John Templeton is, but he's probably in his early 80s. Every year for, I don't know, about 40 years, he makes this big speech, and he says the same thing every year. And essentially, what he's telling people, and he's speaking to professionals, but a lot of clients get to hear these tapes of his speeches, is that you don't have to be right 100% of the time when you invest your money. Whether you choose stocks, bonds, mutual funds, real estate, you only have to be right a certain percentage. Anybody want to venture a guess? And if you've heard his tape, that's okay. What percentage of the time as an investor do you have to be right to beat the averages?
51%.
I'd say half.
Yes.
A little bit more. 60.
60?
So that means you can make significant mistakes.
Wow.
You have to stay in it for long term, though.
Yeah.
And you have to be disciplined and keep investing money. Even when you're withdrawing money, you should still be investing money. You should still be reinvesting your dividends and your interest and your capital gains, etc. So if you're in a stock program or a mutual fund program and are taking $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month out for retirement, which they'll do for you automatically in mutual funds and annuities, if you're withdrawing money for your retirement, you should still be adding monthly and reinvesting monthly, automatically.
How about showing us a pie chart of your recommended mix of total assets for a 7-year-old?
You know that's going to be different from client to client.
Sure is.
Some people I'd have overseas and some people not. So I'm real one-on-one with a client.
If they have more money to spend, you're going to take more risks?
No, not necessarily. Not unless they personally are suited to that. I don't have pie charts with blanket recommendations of percentages. I have rough, you know, guidelines. I think we're done for now, and because we're supposed to stay right on schedule. But so the rest of you are dismissed, and we'll probably have lunch pretty soon. But I do this individually from client to client.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. There's going to be a lot of variation, but the majority for a 70-year-old, the majority is going to be in a combination. If it's mutual funds, they have a balanced portfolio, like 10 balanced funds. So they'll end up probably 40% to 50% in stocks.
Yeah.
And
for a 70-year-old?
Mm-hmm. 40% to 50% in stocks or equities. They'll be fairly conservative equities, you know, real old line blue chips, dividend payers, that kind of stuff. They might have 10% of that in real aggressive growth, even at 70. Now, when I'm working with a 70-year-old client, I am frequently in a fairly long-term relationship with that client. And this is not something we would have gotten to in the first year. It might be 2 or 3 years down the road. So I'm pretty secure that that client understands exactly what we're talking about all the time. Because you can't get to that point of making the decision otherwise. And I'd rather that the person go real vanilla, middle of the road for a year or two before we start getting into the tinkering and the, you know, the fine tuning of a portfolio. Because we don't take much risk by doing that. And I need their money to be invested. They need their money to be invested. You know, they need to do it, but they're not ready to do it with that kind of precision yet. It takes 2 years, that's fine. It takes 3 years, that's fine with me. I don't want to go to that point till the client's ready. But I would, most 70-year-olds, I would hope we would be at least 40, possibly 50% in equities. And the balance would be mixes and high-quality bonds.
Suppose you needed 10% of those assets to live on. You'd still recommend they weren't equities?
Yes.
Why?
You bet.
Because they're going to take withdrawals based on the growth, not the income, or the growth plus income, without question.
I'm saying that their full-up needs are only 10, no matter how you, what you want to call it, capital gains or income, dividends or interest or whatever source.
I would still recommend.
Need 10% of their portfolio level.
Mm-hmm. And they're probably earning 12, so it's growing still.
Why would you have an equity?
See ya.
Why would you have an equity?
Because I have a bias for equities.
Why would you tell them to give it away?
if they want to give it away, fine.
Isn't that the real Christian thing to do?
Depends on the.
I don't understand that at all, frankly.
What?
Your premise there.
Which one?
This notion of multiply. Once you've got as much as you can reasonably live on, why should you possibly want to accumulate more?
You can give it away when it multiplies.
No, I'm not saying you can. Of course you can.
Sure.
I'm talking about the Christian principle behind it. I don't understand that implied notion of wealth accumulation for its own sake.
It's not for its own sake.
It doesn't ever turn the corner and say, now give it to the poor, give it to the needy,
no,
give it to the oppressed.
No, you've misunderstood me.
Well, show me the quotes then that say do that your money.
I don't have time to show you all the quotes.
Okay, but that is the key point.
No. What I'm saying is that you have to multiply it, and of course you're going to give it away.
But
you're
going to
give away 10%.
Pure accumulation is a flawed premise. It's not a Christian premise.
Well, I'm not a theologian.
You don't
obviously
have to be. You just have to be a good Christian that says, once you've satisfied reasonable needs and you have the skill or the talent or the luck of continuing to accumulate wealth,
mm-hmm,
to keep it and look at it and count it like King Midas is counter to the whole notion.
But that's not what
Christianity.
I'm saying. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying with what you retain, you must continually increase its value. You have to keep up with inflation and taxes. You have to increase it that much.
You continue to maintain your life and your needs and those things.
Well, that's multiplying. That's not staying the same.
But there was no qualifier in there that said, once you've done that, then there are better uses for it than further accumulation.
Well, if you read this book, you'll see that I spend quite a bit of time on that qualifier. I don't have time in an hour.
I'm thinking of the man who, the rich man in the eye of the needle notion. That to me is much more of a compelling argument. That's the problem in a nutshell. I accumulate like the rest of the investors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful to see, you know, more and more and more and more. And I know that's not a good Christian approach. I'm trying to reorient to giving it away and not worrying about more, more, more. That's the hard part.
You can't give away what you don't have. And you must take care of your family first.
Oh, that's...
And you know, you may have... You might be a little bit ahead of other people. You got to remember where... In where I'm coming from, I'm trying to make people understand in the first place that their money has to grow in value. And they can, and if they read my book, they'll understand. And if they were to sit in front of my classes for 20 hours, they would understand that I think it would be nice for many of us to give away 50 or 60% of what we make. I have a friend who gives away 90. And so, you know, if we spend enough time together, I would have to agree with you. But I have a responsibility to talk to the vast number of people that are not keeping up with inflation and taxes and are slipping behinder and behinder and behinder. Those people cannot give because they're not meeting their basic needs.
With you more. I'm simply concerned about the Christian approach in its full flower. And there's obviously the two sides to it.
Right.
One is that part, but there is another dimension to it as well. And
we talked about that the other day, about the giving part of it. So you only got a piece of the total picture. And even if you had been here the other day, you would only get a piece of the total picture. And so I think we're probably both right. And probably if we talked long enough, we would agree.
You have to
teach the concept of multiplication. Yeah, it's hard to turn the corner.
Very hard.
I don't think people here, though, that come here have as much trouble with that as people out there in the rest of the world.
Oh, no, you have a much higher affluence.
Well, you have givers here, too. You have people here that understand, that don't question giving 10% to their church and 5% to missions and over and above that, and even sacrificial giving. You have people here that's no problem. But when you get out there in the world, you know, you're going to run into much more of that as a problem. And you know, I deal with a lot of secular, non-believing people as well as Christian people. And it's funny because out there, the non-believers aren't that different from the believers when I get away from a place like this in terms of how they handle money, etc. The big problem, bigger than the multiplying, which is not appropriate for me to lecture this group on, is debt. And I did mention in the previous class the average American's consumer debt is $52,000. When you have that much consumer debt, you don't invest and you don't give.
$5.2 trillion.
Is that per capita or per household?
Per purse, per household, per household per year, or per household current year, $52,000 for the consumer debt. And that's credit cards mostly. That might be a car loan too, but that's a lot. Even if it's a $20,000 car, that's $32,000 worth of credit card and personal loans and department stores. Not including mortgages.
Versus savings habits.
Isn't that incredible?
It's abysmal.
So when you take that and find out that the vast majority of the world is in deep debt, kimchi up to their eyebrows, deep, deep debt, you gotta realize they don't give any money to anybody. They don't save a penny. And if they ever get to the point of investing.
Chinese and Japanese do. They're marvelous exceptions to the rule. They will save it first.
Yeah, they save 10 to 15% on average.
Japanese have been saving 16% since the end of the war.
You know, sometimes though, I have some Japanese clients and some Iranian clients. I think they're turning the corner, that it's not working for them, you know? I think they're creating great stress for themselves in that whole, you know, that whole effort that they made. My Japanese clients, I got a couple, and it's almost becoming a burden, you know?
Well, supposedly their personal standards of living are much lower than ours because they're so hogbound about this notion of not consuming.
Yeah.
Saving, and you're right. What kind of life is it when you're, you know?
I know there's a balance, and the Japanese have done so well for so long, but I get this kind of like intuitive feeling that they've kind of gone over, and they're beginning to suffer individually. You know, like psychically, they're starting to suffer for this way of living that they've had, and they've accumulated so much, but they're all coming apart at the seams.
Yeah, it's like an emotional turmoil for the whole thing.
Yeah, I have had some Japanese students a number of summers and even sometimes
well, the baby boomers that are
and
not
they,
doing what you and I have already done in the way of
they are under so much
sacrifice
stress.
And financial
just letting the Japanese stress. Economy, they are under so they, much stress.
They've been so wrapped up in consuming for so long. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you. Set up what we're going to touch.
Well, actually, I think most everybody was with you. I think they were here for their reasons other than a theological discussion.
But I think that confuses people when you get somebody who has a strong point to make, you know, and then they think, well,
you can be there.
Oh, thank you. Well, I've done a lot of this.
Without being defensive and acknowledging.
Well, she has a valid point, but that wasn't my point, you know.
But I don't know. I think these folks are.
I think so, too.
They have their agenda.
Yeah, I think so, too.
They've got a sense.
This came out late 95, so it's been on the market for what? It's even September. It's been on the market for 10 months, and it's really doing well. I'm really pleased.
Okay.
And it was written to women. You know, I love women.
Well,
my husband read it before his death, and he said, "This is so understandable."
And that was the idea. What you did in the hour is kind of sum up what my husband and I learned in a 20-hour class. I mean, that will simplify to the point of making it just, this is what you need to do. This is mm-hmm. what you need to know. I think. One question I was going to ask you, which I'm sure everybody in the world asks you, is do you give any references for people that you know in the industry that are...
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the hardest thing
mm-hmm.
for new investors is to say, what do? Do I open the phone book? Do I go to my church?
You know what?
How do I find the person with whom I can work?
The best way is to find the person who is going to work for you on the most ethical basis, and there's a way to do that. I firmly believe that somebody who's got credentials behind their name mm-hmm. at least has proven the competency level is there. Because to get the CFP credentials, you must be tested, and it's a very rigorous test. Yeah. It's like passing the CPA or the bar exam. Mm-hmm. You really do have to know. So the CFP, Certified Financial Planner behind the name, mm-hmm. tells you, if nothing else, this person is competent. Mm-hmm. Then you ask that CFP for a complimentary, it's usually going to be 30 minutes, sometimes an hour if they're getting started, interview. We're not going to pay you, we're going to come to your office and we're going to talk with you for 30 minutes. And you write some questions down and you go in, and they might be trick questions. Mm-hmm. You might go wanting to see how they answer a certain thing. Mm-hmm. One of the questions always for hiring a planner, a doctor or an attorney always is, if you wouldn't take mine, if I wasn't going to be your client, if you wouldn't accept me as a client, who would you recommend I go to? Mm-hmm. Hopefully not their partner in their firm, you know.
Yeah.
So you get when you go to five of these people and interview them, you find out who they would go to, who they would refer you to. And that's a reasonably good, you know, referral. Of course, your friends in your church, etc., there might be somebody in there that you could, but you go to them with the same list of questions and you make the decision to work with them on the same basis. Anybody, in addition to having the CFP and giving you a free look-see,
mm-hmm.
a free interview,
mm-hmm.
should, in my opinion, and there's a lot of disagreement on this,
should work on a fee-only basis. They'll be very expensive. So you make sure that your time with them, you get exactly done what you want. You go and you say, we're paying you for an hour and it's XYZ money. This is what we want to accomplish. In other words, you run the show. Because you pay them by the hour. But when you do that, you get objective advice.
See, that's the thing. I think what we did is...
And there are lists of people like that.
Do you have, I mean, do you have personal recommendations for somebody in Seattle?
Oh, yes.
Because, see, what we've done is we went to this seminar that was paid for by All America Financial, you know, another company that sells...
Sells product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And while I appreciated the seminar because it was very informative and helpful and so forth...
I'll give you two names.
They give you the opportunity to go with them, but Scott especially has a trust issue with the people who sell product.
Well, sure. That's an obvious conflict of interest.
Yeah.
By the way, in Washington State, any advisor you work with, you have to sign... like a consulting agreement or an engagement letter with them. Mm-hmm. In that is a disclosure statement that has to list all conflicts of interest. That's the law in Washington State. So you'll know whether they're fee-only or can sell product. And every time they sell a product, the question comes up. Mm-hmm. My disclosure, because I'm fee-only, mm-hmm. says there's no conflict of interest from commissions I accept.